couple different open monologues here. One is Baker's tweet and how that leads to Cleveland angst and angst that you kind of have to sign up for in certain cities. And I also want to talk about the point guard position and how it's changing, and maybe not in a great way in the NBA. Joel Klatt, we're doing it all. College ball, the playoffs, our picks for the title game, of course, the SEC topic, and a life advice that leans aggressive towards the end. It's the Ryan Russillo podcast presented by FanDuel. Take a shot at betting the NBA with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Right now, you can check out the new and improved Parlay Hub. Filter by odds, sport, and bet type to easily find the most popular parlays and same-game parlays all on one page. Plus, start betting the Explore page and the Pulse and bet live same-game parlays for every NBA game. So download the app today and bet with FanDuel, official partner of the NBA. The Ringer is committed to responsible gaming. Please visit rg-help.com to learn more about the resources and helplines available. And listen to the end of the episode for additional details. Must be 21 and older and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com. This episode is brought to you by Hulu Plus Live TV. Looking for a better way to watch live TV? Stream your favorite sports and shows on over 95 live channels with Hulu Plus Live TV. Get access to Hulu's entire streaming library, Disney Plus and ESPN Plus, all in one plan. Start your free trial of Hulu Plus Live TV today. Live TV plan required. Restrictions apply. Access content from each service separately. Learn more at Hulu.com. I want to start today's podcast with a couple different topics that have nothing to do with the other one. One's going to be NBA point guard stuff that I'm going to get to a little bit later. It's just kind of something I've been working on and thinking about. Certainly not the most detailed thing that I've ever worked on. But we had a little news over the week, and that's Baker Mayfield. This has been a really frustrating season again for the Cleveland Browns. We'll get to that. That's nothing new. And Baker now 4 years in, a guy you took number one overall, which, again, it wasn't like they were on an island when Cleveland took Baker number one overall. There were other teams in the top 10 mix that I'd heard prior to that definitely liked Baker. But it was kind of that last 24 to 48 hours. I remember when all that news was happening, like, wait, Cleveland's taking Baker one because of all the guys that were in that draft. Like, man, that's the guy that you want to go with. And at this point, it hasn't worked out. Statistically, this season, you know, the picks to touchdown ratio is the worst he's ever had. I mean, honestly, their season last year, he was pretty good. If you look at some of the raw stats, he's hurt, right? We can say that. I think we can all agree that he's hurt. And it's been terrible this year. But, you know, is it just because he's hurt? Has he been the guy that you'd hoped he would be if you're a Cleveland Browns fan? Like, definitely not. There was also, I think, at the end of one of the years, a couple years ago, where you went, wow, this guy turned a corner. He started figuring some things out. And really, it probably had to do more with the opponents than it was necessarily him becoming this franchise quarterback. But when you enter the season, and if you looked at the Pro Football Focus stuff, they do kind of roster talent ranking 1 through 32. And you could look at other places too. If you look at the Browns roster in totality, it was kind of like a top five, like around number five, maybe number six overall roster ranking. And you can debate that all you want, but I think we'd all agree that the Browns, coming into the year, we thought this was going to be a really good football team, and now they're 6-8 with another week to go. Again, I've watched him enough this year that I do think that he's hurt. The fifth-year option was already picked up. Maybe he's going to demand a trade. Some of that stuff was out there because it's the fifth year trying to figure out not only where you fit in with a franchise, but also what kind of money you're going to get. And let's not kid ourselves. And then you still have the coaching change where I don't know what the disconnect with he and Stefanski is. I don't know what's real. I don't know what isn't. So Mary Kay Cabot, who's been covering the Browns forever, had a piece where she titled it basically, Baker Mayfield must resolve his differences with Stefanski soon in case they need to coexist next season. In case. So, you know, that's kind of leaving open the idea that he might not even be around. Also some names that will be on the radar if they don't. So Baker quote tweeted it and said, clickbait. You and many other Cleveland local media continue to be drama stirring reporters with no sources or facts. Don't put words in my mouth so you can put food on your table. I'm not your puppet. Boom. All right. So I can understand his point. When you are this level of the focus of not only a city's attention, but nationally as a quarterback in the NFL, it's probably not a lot of fun to read all the shit about you all the time. But Baker also kind of can't help himself. And anybody, we kind of understand like the fundamental rules of an argument. If you've done something wrong or you're blamed for something, but somebody coming at you makes a mistake or maybe gets like one of the five things wrong that they're accusing you of, you focus on the thing that they're saying that's not true. And then you dismiss every one of their other things that may be true. I mean, this is defense 101, right? We've all done it. We've probably done it to other people in arguments. And this is the part where the public figure, even if they might be right and you know, they want to be, they want to defend themselves. It just never really seems to go over that well, especially when you don't win, right? When you don't win, nobody has your back. You know, it's the same thing with the ads. I remember when RG3 lights it up his rookie year, he's doing a bunch of ads. Really, his downfall was he couldn't keep himself healthy. I think he butted heads with Washington's play calling and the offense coming in the second year. But what did it turn into? Like, oh, RG3, he's just doing too many ads. You know, a little less Subway, a little more completions. And Baker, who's great in all these ads, is in a bunch of ads. They lose games. It's like, okay, where's this guy's head at? And none of that necessarily is fair, but he needs to be better. He needs to be better both as a quarterback. He needs to be healthier. And he probably could do a better job of just sitting some of these things out when you're not winning games. Because again, when you're not winning, no one's really going to be on your side. Let's do a hard turn on this, all right? This isn't necessarily this open about Baker specifically or even Mary Kay Cabot's position. Mary Kay sends out her tweet about a story about a lot of questions to ask. Fair. Baker fights back saying some of the stuff isn't true, and I get his point. Baker's tweet has over 66,000 likes. He hasn't had many likes because you have a bunch of Browns fans who are like, this again? We're doing a quarterback thing again? Been doing this for decades. So this speaks to the angst not only of Cleveland, but any fan in a fan base in a city that cares this much. This is about them hoping this isn't true because a lot of you have signed up for some seriously bad deals with your favorite franchises. You know, I have a ton of, I don't think sympathy is really the right word here. I just like Cleveland. I do. I like those fans. And I sympathize with their plight and why when they came back from 3-1 against Golden State to beat them and the city to get a championship that had been waiting on forever, when it got emotional for these people, like, that's a big deal. This is one of the historic sports cities in this country with decades of failure, all right, in all of their sports prior to that. When you look back at the Browns, the last championship was 1964, all right? 1964. Cleveland Indians' last World Series title was 1948. And it kind of speaks to some of these other franchises, too, that are sitting around forever. Like, imagine being a Vikings fan. Franchise starts up in 1961 and you've never won a title. Like, can you imagine that? Being 60, growing up with it? You're like, yep, they've never won. I mean, you could even start to ask yourself, like, questions go, is this even worth it? I was watching the Knicks game with the Celtics last night. And they're like, you know, coming up on 50 years for the Knicks and the last title in 1973. Can you imagine winning that title? Say you're 10 years old, right? And you're like, man, this is awesome. Knicks won a title, two in what, like the last three or four seasons? Hey, man, it's going to be like 50 years. And who knows now? I mean, it could be another 10, right? I mean, it's not crazy to say the Knicks are probably, I don't know how many years they are away from the next championship. Could it be longer than that? Maybe something crazy happens in free agency and a trade here or there, 5 years, they're having some kind of parade. But would you, if you knew that, all right? So this is speaking to Browns fans, Knicks fans, Vikings, you know, pick whatever. We can go Seattle, San Diego in baseball, but I'm not going to sit here and go through an entire list of championship droughts for franchises. But that's kind of the question here, and why the Baker thing always is a little bit more tuned up, I think, than just another top quarterback flaming out. And I'm not even sure he's necessarily at the flame out phase, because again, I think it's pretty clear he's, as much as everybody beat him up on social media, you know, I don't think he looks right. So, you know, is it making an excuse for him? I just think we're kind of telling the truth about the full scope of the Baker Mayfield conversation. But the reason for the angst is a lot about the cities and their histories. And it's, you know, I always think I come from a really good perspective on this because I grew up as an insane fan about things. You know, my mood was directly related to whether or not my football team won on the weekend, much like all of you listening to this today. You know, the Red Sox up and downs for me weren't healthy. In a way, I miss that I care that much. In a way, I love that I don't. And I'm not sure what's better. Sometimes I miss caring about the outcomes of things the way that I did when I was younger, but I got desensitized to it. I was in it nonstop. And when your passion becomes your profession, it's an incredible career, but it also is just going to kind of change the way you filter stuff. And I also think just being older, having some stuff, kids, dependents, real life worries, as opposed to being in your 20s and going, yeah, I don't know. Like, what do you think I'm doing? 7 to 10, I'm watching the Red Sox. Like, what, you want me to go do something? You want me to go to a dinner? You want me to meet up? No, like, I'm not doing that. You know, Hippolyta Pichardo's starting. I'm going to see if they can get strong six out of him. So I remember, you know, that Yankees run in the mid 90s being just hell for anybody who was a Red Sox fan. In 96, you're like, well, they shouldn't have won that one. And then they, come back after the Marlins win in 97, you're just like, this is the worst. They're so awesome. They win every game. They're like the lock of the century. I remember I actually bet them for the series in 2002 against the Angels money line. And I was like, whatever, I'm just going to take this free money. The Yankees win every series. That was a loss. That was a tough fall for your boy. But I remember working with this other guy who was older than me. And then, you know, he was a big Yankees fan. Great guy. Way back when I was in Vermont. And I'm like, yeah, man, Yanks, you know, they just won the World Series again. I was like, they're on a roll. I was like, it must be awesome. You know, I was like, what's that feel like? I was like, I hate it. Like, I'm in a bad mood now for a couple of years because of this, but what's it like? He's like, well, you know, my mother died last week, man. So, you know, my enjoyment out of it is not quite the same, you know, going through stuff like that. He's like, you know, I'm happy they won, but you know, my mother died last week. And I was like, yeah, oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. I was like, but God, that team's fucking stacked, huh? And he's just like, all right, yep, got it, dude. And again, that was because I was in my own little world and I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. I'm sorry about your mom, but God, you bullpen, you've got so many options. So I would ask anybody, like even if you looked at the Celtics and said, okay, the last title was 2008, what if the next title is not for 20 years? Would you sign up for that? Like if you were a Vikings fan in the 70s, you know, they're making the championship game. You're like, yeah, it's going to be 2020, whatever, and they're still not going to win one. You want to do that deal? And it's why when it happens, it's so fulfilling. And it's why when it happens in a city that's not used to having it happen, whether it's the Milwaukee Bucks or the Cavs, you know, Chicago, the Cubs getting their first one in forever. You know, we've had a few over the last few years where these cities have finally been rewarded. And when you're rewarded that first time, it's got to be an incredible feeling. But I don't know that anybody would ever sign up for some of these deals if you said, hey, this title, the Cleveland Indians won a World Series in 1948. They made the playoffs once from 1949 to 1994. Would you ever be like, and again, you know, we're talking the late 40s here, but would you say, and the format was a little different for baseball, but I don't know when you say it out loud, if any fan would say, oh, so they're never going to win for like, I don't know. Like if they won when I was 10, I'll be 60 with grandkids and it still hasn't happened again. Yeah, sign me up for that. I'm in. When you say it out loud, I don't think many of you would. This episode is brought to you by Arby's, the perfect sandwich. Let me think. Buffalo chicken sandwiches done right can change your life. I've never been the same in the best way possible when I experienced my first one. Also loving to travel, I've had gyros, also known as gyros. I think if you go to Arby's and you order a gyro, they're not going to judge you. And that's what I like about them. Nice chicken, perfectly sauced, butter lettuce, good body. You know what I'm talking about. And that's what Arby's has. They have more than you may even realize. Get out there and explore. Well, now is the chance to try Arby's and find your favorite sandwich. With a wide range of options, see for yourself that Arby's sells more than roast beef. Plus, for a limited time, Arby's Rewards members get one free sandwich with purchase every week in April online only. Simply join Arby's Rewards and order ahead today. Order on the app or Arby's.com. I want to talk about point guards in the NBA. Position's never been deeper. Insane talent. Going back, I would say less than 20 years, things have changed the last 10. Combo guard was a dirty word coming out of the draft. All right. If you were a guard in college who played point, but you were a score first point guard, I was like, I don't know. He's not like a traditional point guard. We don't have traditional point guards anymore. We just don't. We have Chris Paul, you know, a couple of other guys that do get people set up and everything. But now it's almost weird if you don't have a score first point guard. And I'm going to go through some of those teams a little bit later on. I was watching the Celtics game last night. They're now 2-11 in games decided by 5 points or less. It's comical how bad they are at the end of these games. And it's not just luck. There was two plays last night. They blew a 25-point lead to the Knicks. They were doubling Tatum. Their defensive philosophy was incredibly simple. Tatum gets the ball, two stay with Tatum, leave Marcus Smart or Dennis Schroeder wide open to take threes. Okay, well, that didn't work. It was so bad that there was an inbounds to Tatum where he was bringing it across half court, and they went to trap him behind half court, and no one from the Celtics was there as a valve to, like, help him. It's like, hey, they've been doubling him every fucking time, and you guys can't figure this out. to at least have somebody else be close to him. And it almost led to a turnover. And then they didn't challenge a ball that went out of bounds off of Mitchell Robinson that was painfully obvious. And for whatever reason, they didn't challenge that one either. Celtics are a mess. Moving on. There's a bigger point here, though. The point guard position, the one that I grew up with, it wasn't about, you know, could you make shots? I always felt like it was kind of this identifiable thing when you watched it. It wasn't just assist totals. It was, all right, we've had two or three terrible possessions in a row. Let's figure some stuff out here. Like, let me get us settled. Let me get somebody set up. I'm going to call this. I've seen this. I'm doing this. So when you ISO all game, or you have point guards that don't really think the game that way, you know, where Jason Kidd would come down and go, all right, this is what we need right now. Gary Payton be like, enough of this shit. Like, I need to get somebody else going here. We need to take advantage of something. I think the league is actually missing that part of it. And it was such a stark contrast from watching the Celtics sit there not being able to figure out the same defense for like 8 minutes to close the game versus Phoenix beating the Clippers. Again, it's the Clippers. But Chris Paul in a moment going, all right, take over time. I'm going to make sure everything we do at least gives us a really nice look. All right. Doesn't mean every possession is perfect, but it means I'm going to give us a better chance. I'm going to set us up in a way that gives us a better chance to take advantage of something. I'm going to balance that out as well. And I'm going to shoot when I need to shoot, but I'm not going to shoot every time just because we're down by seven. And it's a transition to the league where it's amazing how talented the point guard position is, but it's evolved to a point now where I feel like you can see late game situations where it's like, all right, high screen and roll, three or kick to the corner. Like that's not playing the point guard position. That's not understanding. I mean, honestly, LeBron is, you know, brilliant at this. Once again, a lot of the stuff that he does that's great is understanding, okay, in this moment, what do we need to do a little bit differently after three or four bad possessions? And I think some of these guys that are just six scorers, like they're unbelievable talents, I don't know that they think the game this way. And we used to be loaded with guards that way that actually didn't look to score as much. So when I look through all the champions, and I don't know how far back we want to go, there'll probably be a little dispute here and there on kind of how I paraphrase this, but this is just a wing league. And if you run through all the title winners, you know, Milwaukee with Giannis, he's definitely a different big, but he's still more of a wing than he is a traditional center. And again, they play with a five-out center anyway in Brook Lopez, or they can play with Giannis. The Lakers, that's wings. Again, Anthony Davis, when he would want to play center. Toronto Raptors, you know, who's the main guy? It's a wing in Kawhi. Golden State, I can make it about Durant to make this argument stronger, but it isn't just about Durant. But Steph is such a different point guard in that it's not just the shooting, it's the assist, is he plays like a wing off the ball. And there's just other point guards that don't do that. We don't need to list them all again. I think I've done enough of that content. Cleveland, two wings, you know, whatever you want to call Kyrie, but he's still probably better as an off-the-ball guy as he is on the ball. Just as dynamic as he is, he's not going to see the game the way some of the guys that I'm talking about, you know, that I grew up with. Golden State, 2015, Steph played point in that. Him figuring out Cleveland's double team was what turned that series. San Antonio, 2014, in the comeback against Miami, or not the comeback, but the revenge series against Miami. That was Kawhi at that point as a wing. Miami, two wings, and Dwayne and LeBron. Dallas, not a big, not a point guard, but a stretch four, and Dirk. The Lakers with Kobe back-to-back wing. Celtics, it was wings. It was more KG, though, that really changed that thing around. Not that he's a traditional center. Perk was playing center, but it was about those guys more than it was a point guard and Rondo or Perk a center. 2007, I know Tony Parker was the guy that closed it out in the finals, but let's face it, if Duncan, who's basically playing center, even though Spurs fans always try to argue that he's not a center, whatever. If Parker's in that series without Duncan, Parker's not playing in the finals. You know, if Duncan's on Memphis, I don't think San Antonio's winning all these NBA championships. Miami was a point guard-led kind of thing, almost with Dwayne Wade just having the ball all the time because prime Dwayne Wade was impossible to stay in front of, and then he took a million free throws. Spurs, Duncan, Pistons. Is Chauncey the most important player on the team? Maybe it's Ben Wallace. Could be a bit of an aberration. We'll get back to that. Spurs, Duncan again. Lakers, Shaq and Kobe. Maybe Shaq the most traditional big of the guys most recent to win it, which is still like 20 years ago. So, you know, we keep going. We go Jordan, we go Olajuwon. The Detroit Pistons, 89-90, might be the best example of a point guard-led team that won a title. So even with the depth of this position, which again, is it cannot be argued how many terrific point guards we have, there's still moments where you go, wait, do I need that score first point guard to win a title? I mean, look, if you have a player who's available, who's great, you add that player to your team, right? If Dame Lillard is available at some point, you go, well, you never still did the segment about point guards not leading your team. But it's a real thing. It's a real thing. And I just wonder if the combo guard evolution has led to that position being a little less important despite the numbers that we see from that position. Because, like, whether it's Dame, you know, them making the Western Conference Finals a couple years ago, like, nice run, but I wouldn't ever look at them as a title contender. They were still bad defensively and, you know, whatever. That thing's gone off the rails and, you know, those guys aren't even in the lineup right now. Trey, who I thought turned a corner last year, I don't know if he's kind of backed it into a different corner that he used to be in. This season, really nice story last year for Atlanta. But then is there a next step that exists? I really like Darius Garland a lot, but him trying to score on his own to close out Cavs games probably isn't the best version of this team offensively. And obviously Rubio not being there hurts them and doesn't allow Darius to do some stuff off the ball that he does when he's there. Utah kind of went with Donovan Mitchell. Obviously they've had Conley the last couple of years. Russell Westbrook, I think my position is clear on that. D'Angelo Russell, maybe just as clear. DeJounte Murray with San Antonio, who I really like a lot. But, you know, again, that roster, I'm not sure what to do with it. De'Aaron Fox, where it was kind of like, look what this guy is capable of, pivoting to, wait, is this guy really like a guy? I know he's making that kind of money. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, whatever it is that Houston's doing, and then maybe even Zion a little bit. So it's just a simple question in that if you're looking at all these point guard numbers and all the talent, the position, it's fun to watch. But what does it really mean? Because history tells us that that position doesn't really dictate who's winning a championship. So, Rudy, do you have anything on that?
I would just say that, you know, like, look at a guy like Cole Anthony, right? Let's bring my Magic into it. He's having a good year, 26-6. But, you know, he's probably a mid to lower end starting point guard, I would say, in the NBA. And he's still super talented and he's putting up great numbers. There's just an abundance of talent at the position that where, unless you have one of the top elite guys, the Jaws, I'd probably throw Trey in there, Steph. It's kind of an easy position to fill, right? So, you know, I don't know, like, if you have a top pick, right? And it's between a point guard and a wing, I'm always going wing. This goes back to our argument about, like, you know, the Mobley thing. Like, I'm always going to lean towards a wing because of what you just said about how that is who wins championships in the NBA. Like, I think Mobley would probably be more valuable than, you know, a really good point guard in the league. And I think the point guard position, like, there's just so many of these guys, you could probably find one in free agency or via a trade. You know, look at, you know, the guy that everybody's talking about, De'Aaron Fox. He's probably, what, somewhere in the range of like 15 to 20th best point guard in the league. And he's available and he's really good. So I just think it, you know, unless you have one of the top 3, 4, 5 guys, there's a lot of guys that are kind of the same.
Yeah, and I would put Kyle Lowry in that group of some of the more old school approaches at times because, you know, however I feel about Lowry, who I think is one of the three most annoying people to watch play a basketball game, he's so smart and he'll know, like, oh, okay, you know, this hasn't worked. This is something I can take advantage of. Or when Lowry's like, all right, look, they're one away from the penalty and we need some easy ones. I'll go in and have a big guy fall into me and now I'm at the free throw line. That shit wins games. And Lowry sees it. Paul has always seen it, but we used to have, that's what the position used to be. What do we need? Okay, I'm going to provide what we need. And now I think it's simply, oh, we're losing. Well, I'll just shoot. And like anybody that's ever played basketball, it's awesome when you have a great player, but it's fucking lame sitting around while four guys watch somebody do something the entire time. You know, it's just not fun to play with. And it changes your defensive effort. It changes how much you want to box out. It changes how much you want to screen. There's a real harmony in basketball that is unlike any other sport where you still have to worry about the feelings and investment of those around you. And so even though we've seen, I think, with some of the number stuff where, you know, on paper, it sounds like a great idea. Like, hey, we have an amazing player in James Harden. You know, James Harden's passing and his getting people involved. Like, I don't think every assist is created equally, but I think Harden's passing is actually really incredible. But peak Houston years, it's like, wait, we're just going to watch you dribble the whole fucking time. The usage stuff that we've seen with like the top guys, like, why would I want the ball in anyone else's hands? And there's extremes. Like, why do you want Steph shooting corner threes and never having the ball, like the early Golden State stuff, where he kind of did this hybrid thing with Jarrett Jack? But then in the other extreme, it's like, does that mean that the best guy has to have the ball every single time because his points per shot is the best number? Because does that diminish who you could be potentially on the whole? And I think it's a healthy conversation. It's something that's worth debating. But it was such a stark contrast last night seeing Chris Paul take over in the minutes that mattered and everything working out. He was just brilliant again. And then watching the Celtics do the same thing every possession without anybody kind of going like, hey, why don't we try something a little different? And that's where the point guard is far more important than some play a coach is going
to
call.
And that's what I was going to say. Ask Marcus Smart to your original point. What's he think about the ball movement in Boston? He's basically come out and been like, this is BS.
And Tatum still was making the right plays, but you know, if you're going to go, hey, double, and then we throw it to this guy, you just become really, really easy to defend. And again, back to my point, the best point guards go, let's do something different. So they have to think about how they're defending us. And I feel like that part of the game is diminishing. I don't really think there's much of an argument about it, to be honest with you. So there you go.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. When I went on my last holiday to Cape Town, it was amazing. My friends were there, the weather was phenomenal, and most importantly, the food was fantastic. But one thing I struggled with was finding the right places to stay. You know, all I want is a great bed, a fantastic shower, and breakfast that doesn't end at 8 a.m. I'm on holiday, I'm still sleeping. I also like ease, and the Hotels.com app easily helps me to find a perfect hotel for every trip. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly getaway or a relaxing spa weekend, on the Hotels.com app, you can compare up to 5 hotels side by side. Now, why would you want to do that? So you can see prices, amenities, and star ratings. And best of all, you don't have to switch back and forth between options. See? Ease. So, start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app today.
One of the biggest voices in college football, a guy I'm a fan of, Joel Klatt of Fox, joins us on the podcast. Also remind everybody, Breaking the Huddle airs Wednesday. New show on FS1 that's 9:30 Pacific time, and also hosting the National Championship live tailgate on the night of the National Championship as we are less than a week away. So what's up, man? Good to have you on.
It's good to be here. I know we've been trying to do this all year. I'm glad we finally got it done here before the biggest game of the year.
I know. You got like Grammy winners that are easier booking than you, Joel. No. Yeah, I know you're a busy guy. That's why I've enjoyed this. So let's take a look at, you know, recapping a bit of what we saw as we kind of look ahead to what the title game may be. You know, look, I thought Michigan had a chance. I'd like what Cade had been. I knew what they did best was not exactly a recipe for beating Georgia, because what they did best is exactly what Georgia does. And then it was horrifying. So what do you think happened in that game?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. The problem was the matchup. Yeah, this was a terrible matchup for Michigan. I think Michigan would have matched up much better against Alabama. Not that they would have won. Obviously, they would have been matched up better against Cincinnati, but Michigan had a what I would call like a prerequisite to success offensively, which was they had to be able to run the football at least a little bit and establish that run in order to get to some of the play action and the wrinkles that they were so good at, which made them explosive. And Georgia totally took that away. I mean, absolutely dominated them at the line of scrimmage. That defensive front seven is the best in college football, and I don't know if it's quite all that close, to be honest with you. They were just too strong. They were too active. The linebacker, N'Kobe Dean, was too fast. Michigan didn't have a chance. And it was pretty clear, I thought, within the first 3 minutes of the game. I was like, okay, this is not going to go well for Michigan. And I don't think that they've got many places to go in terms of adjustments to make this a game. And they didn't.
Yeah, that was, I think, the part that was, you know, we knew Michigan was running the football. We knew that. With the way, you know, I thought one of those Ohio State stats that was unbelievable about that matchup was that Ohio State didn't have a tackle for loss in that Michigan game for the first time in like 16 years. And you go, whoa, all right. So, you know, we know what they are on the edge for Michigan. We know how the offensive line holds up there a little bit. But I felt like, you know, whether it's my buddy Cannell or just kind of the way it works geographically, people just started dumping on Georgia, especially feeling like, hey, see, after they lost to Bama, they didn't play anybody. This team's completely overrated. Yeah, maybe they should have been a tier on their by themselves. But my point was always kind of like, you don't house teams the way you're doing it if you're Georgia and you're not bad. Okay. You're not like an average team when you're holding teams like 7 points per game. So is there enough there, you think, this time around? Like when you're looking at Georgia and going, hey, this team can learn some things. They had enough things go wrong in Bama that you feel good about their chances.
Well, this is such a cliche. Don't roll your eyes. But man, it's hard to beat a team twice, especially a good team, right? And so because they have the ability of hindsight and they can make adjustments, and they will. They're going to make adjustments. And I don't love this excuse, but Georgia only had, I don't want to say they didn't have motivation in that game. They wanted to win the SEC championship. They want to beat Alabama, but they knew that the entirety of their future was ahead of them, regardless of the outcome of that game. And I don't want to overplay that, because I think that players go out there and they want to be competitive and they want to play their best, but there's no way that Georgia was at their best that day against Alabama. Meanwhile, Alabama was up against the wall. They had to win that game. They knew they had to win that game, or else they weren't going to continue and go to the postseason in terms of the playoff. So that alone, I think, makes this a far different matchup. And then I think that the adjustments that Georgia can make in the front seven, and namely their ability to produce at least some pressure on Bryce Young. This is where the game is ultimately going to be won or lost, is because if Bryce Young can just sit there in the pocket and win down the field, I think that Alabama could have a similar outcome as what they had in the SEC championship game. But if Georgia can get to him and force him off of his spot and force him to play under even similar duress to what Cade McNamara played under, then Georgia is probably going to win that game. And again, trying to beat a defense like that twice with a guy like Kirby Smart as a defensive coordinator, defensive coach, if you will, and Dan Lanning twice is going to be very difficult to do. I fully expect him to make a fair deal of adjustments, in particular with that front seven and trying to create some pressure in Bryce Young's face, because that's what did not happen in the SEC championship game.
Yeah, and that's why it was just so surprising. And, you know, I've always felt like you can kind of tweak an offensive line to fix your problems, but we had had, you know, anybody listening to this podcast, I'm repeating it for you because we haven't talked about it, but people listening to this are going to be like, oh, here we go again. But whether it was not being able to block A&M, not being able to run the football against LSU, likely losing that Auburn game against TJ Finley on one leg. I mean, he couldn't even stop Arkansas defensively. So we had more examples of Bama not looking like Bama than ever before. And then you put it up against this front seven against Georgia. You're like, all right, so wait, they're just going to block these guys overnight. And that's exactly what they did. They got the ball out. I mean, the weird thing about it, because I don't think Cincinnati had much of a chance.
No.
But it felt like Cincinnati confused Bryce more in a semifinal game they lost than the SEC title game effort by Georgia. Like, I still felt like Bryce was a little choppy in some moments against Cincinnati.
Yeah.
And I didn't see that against Georgia. So go ahead.
Well, I would just say, I would say this. And it's been so long. I'm so old. It's been so long since I actually played. But I will tell you, when you play against a structure of defense in practice, because that's what your defense plays in spring football and fall camp, that's what you see the majority of. It's more rare to be preparing on a Tuesday and Wednesday against a defense like Cincinnati. See, Bryce Young took very few snaps against the 3-3-5 stack defense, right? And it's a unique style of defense. And it's one of the reasons that we see Baylor have success in the Big 12 is because they use this unique style and they confuse teams. Texas Tech, similar to that. Even Oklahoma State, something similar to that. And it's hard from a quarterback perspective because there's not the defining factors that you see in other defenses. So think of it this way. Every time a quarterback walks up to the line of scrimmage at any level, he's trying to determine whether the middle of the field is open or closed. And that's a, you know, you've heard, I'm sure, Cannell and all these guys, all of us talk about this from a quarterback perspective. But the reason that you're trying to determine whether the middle of the field is open or closed is because that will tell you the nature of the defense and every part of that defense. The entire structure that defense comes out of is that middle of the field open or closed. Is there two safeties open or is there one safety closed? That tells you everything that you need to know about run ratios, about structure, where the support is coming from in the defense, whether it's from the first level or the second level or even the third level. In the 3-3-5, that doesn't really happen, okay? Because they can play structures of coverage that look closed but play with the nature of open. And so it's very difficult. So one of the reasons why Bryce Young is just so comfortable against Georgia is because that defense that Georgia runs is cut from the same cloth as what he sees in practice every single day, in particular when you're talking about spring practice and fall camp, because Kirby and Nick have such a long history together. Okay, so he sees those adjustments. He sees the nature of that defense, and it's easy for him to react to. You get him against Cincinnati, and while Cincinnati might not be as talented as what Georgia is defensively, and they might not be as good of a defense, it can be more confusing for a guy like Bryce Young. And I think that's the reason why you saw at times, it was like, man, is Bryce off? Is the passing game off? Well, part of it is that you see this new style of defense for the first time, and it's hard to adjust.
Yeah, that's a great point, by the way. I think that's actually one of the best answers that I've heard on trying to, you know, look at, hey, something I'm comfortable with, something I'm not. Because also we saw in that first drive against Cincy, I mean, it's just very clear, other than Beavers, Zero, who's kind of a defensive tackle for Cincy, just body type-wise, when you see it on the field, when you actually, like, we can know what the roster says. I'll never forget Oregon, Ohio State, the second time Oregon was in the national championship game, and I was on the field, and I picked Oregon on the show of Van Pelt, and I was walking around. I go, I want to change my pick now. I want to change it right now. Okay. I go, I'm changing. So you and I are on the record on Tuesday. I have changed my pick because it wasn't just the side. I was watching the guys move around. And right. I was like, this is. And so, you know, I think once you saw Cincinnati line up against Alabama, you're like, yeah, okay. I mean, right? Same page.
I mean, it was the first for me. I mean, I hate to be this guy. And I am not going to listen. Cincinnati deserved to be there.
Absolutely.
And I'm glad that they were there. The first run play of the game from Alabama, I was like, oh, this is not going to go well for Cincinnati. And I think that the frustrating part, as good of a coach as Luke Fickell is, and as well as they have done in his tenure there, that was a, I don't want to sound too harsh, but what, I mean, it is what it is. That was a massive coaching fail from them in that semifinal game. Massive. Just think about this. You've got as a tandem, the two best corners in college football.
Right. Kobe and Gardner.
Kobe and Gardner. Right. Sauce Gardner. I mean, these guys are going to be, Kobe's probably going to be a second, late second, third round pick. Good player, good ball skills, strong. Sauce Gardner is a legitimate, possibly top corner in the draft, certainly number two corner in the draft, first round guy, like legit dude. They are the best option that you have defensively. And they never committed all the resources to stopping the run. It was like, hey, we're just going to go in there and our game plan is to allow Alabama to just hand the football off and win the game and just completely dominate up front. That is a massive coaching fail. And again, I like Luke a lot. That can't be your game plan. Your game plan cannot be, we're definitely going to lose and just get bludgeoned in the head by the run game. Not with those guys on the outside. They should have zeroed up, meaning zero safeties, go back to the technical term, played man coverage, and said, listen, our best player is Sauce Gardner, Ahmad Gardner, and he's going to cover Jamison Williams wherever he goes on the field, and we're going to take our chances. And if Bryce Young and Jamison Williams beat us and beat Sauce Gardner, Ahmad Gardner, then their best is beating our best. But what we're not going to allow them to do is just sit there and run the ball down our throats to the tune of over 200 yards from Brian Robinson and not adjust, because the defensive line was never going to stop that run game. It was never going to happen. And you saw that the very first carry of the game. After the very first drive of the game, when Alabama, I believe they only threw one pass. I mean, they went right down the field, right down the field. The entire game plan should have been scrapped right there. And I would have gone zero coverage, every resource to stopping the run. And if you still get beat, fine. But I never saw that adjustment. And I know I get frustrated at things like that, but I get frustrated because I'm like, I just didn't feel like the coaching staff gave their players the best chance to compete in that game because they didn't allow those corners to just get after it.
The weird thing is, you know, I don't know how history will remember it because Cincinnati had 6 points, you know, but it's surprising that Bam only had 27, knowing that it was one of those things where it was like watching somebody in a fight and somebody was like, I may not be landing a million punches, but I'm just holding you here. And you're helpless. There's not going to be anything that you can do. So it sounds like as we kind of sift through all this, I feel like you're leaning Georgia in the rematch.
I am. Georgia was the better team for the majority of the season. I think you would agree with that.
Oh, yeah.
Because of what you just said earlier, you talked about the times in which we saw some vulnerabilities from Alabama, and those were real. You can't, you know, like,
the better teams, you probably. But I can, you know what, though? I mean, LSU, who barely had anybody left at the end of it, so I don't even know what to do with that game. But that'll be one of the weirdest stats ever. Bama ran for 6 yards against a depleted LSU team. Like, how does that happen?
It's a wild stat. Their lack of execution in the red zone, in particular inside the 10-yard line, cost them against Texas A&M. They should have lost the game against Auburn if Auburn just executes as far as clock management goes. Those are factual things, right? This is not a knock against Alabama. Georgia played this year for the majority of the time, like a dominant number one team. Dominant. We saw that in the semifinal. They did not play that way against Bama in the SEC championship game for whatever reason. I think Georgia is the better football team. Bama has the best player in Bryce Young. Will Anderson is going to have a factor in this. I'm going to pick Georgia. I don't generally in these types of championship games pick against the best quarterback in the game, but I'm going to in this one because I just feel like it's going to be really difficult to beat that defense from Georgia twice. I really do. In particular, without Mechie, you know, you're going to be able to roll coverage if you're Kirby. You're going to be able to sit there and just focus on Jamison Williams and really let that defensive front seven go. So I'm going to go with Bulldogs.
Yeah, and the Mechie part, too, is huge. And another reason why you could probably get on Cincinnati, at least with its coverage design, where it's like you have one guy you have to worry about. I mean, the tight ends for Bama, you know, they're okay, but they're not scary. So, and I don't know.
It was pretty clear that Cincinnati was fine letting them snap the ball 10 and 11 times to score and saying, well, at least we didn't get taken out by a haymaker. You know, they were out there to not get knocked out in the first round. I felt like that game plan was to say we lasted all 12 rounds in this championship fight and we went to a decision versus like, man, they clobbered us early and it was over.
All right, let's take a look at it. Our favorite topic, which you and I don't talk about a lot personally because we haven't talked in a while, but we have done this before. The conference hierarchy stuff, which we always seem to be at odds on. Where are you now with what is now, you know, look, it's a 5-7 record for the SEC. It will be 6-8. I think the hardcore propaganda people, depending on which side you are on, are super happy about this. The same way the SEC had a good bowl record last year, so that meant everything in the world. Sometimes the bowl things can be weird. I think this year is a good example of it. So I'm not being dismissive of a bad SEC standard bowl record. It was a bad record. They lost some games to some really good teams. But where are you with this, what becomes a cyclical angst for about 4 or 5 months of every college football year?
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like The conference hierarchy conversation, in order to be fair about it, has to be broken up into 3 tiers. What are you at the top? What are you in the middle? And what are you at the bottom? And if you're not doing that, if you're going to lump everything in, I think that's when you're just going to argue for argument's sake. Because you cannot argue that any conference is superior to the SEC at the top end. You can't. They are the best conference at the top end. Their best teams are better than anybody else's top teams. In the middle of the conference, I think you can make a strong argument that it is even or even tilted towards the Big Ten in the middle of the conference. And then in the bottom end, I mean, who really cares, you know, who's the best of the worst? But that's another conversation for another day. Who's your worst team? Who are they beating? Do they give a challenge to a top-tier team in your conference? But I really believe that's the case. And that's why I get in trouble in these conversations, is because I will say things like, the SEC is really average in the middle. The middle of that conference had a terrible year this year. They were very average during the entirety of the regular season, and that proved out to be the case during the bowl season. And people will say, like, you can't say the SEC is bad. I'm not. I'm saying that the middle of the conference was average this season. The top end of the conference is the best every year in college football, and it bears out whether it's the NFL draft or in championship season when we're crowning national championships. But that nuance tends to be lost when you just want to be in a conversation that you're either chanting SEC or you're not. And you can't live in that space, because I'm sorry, but there's no other conference that so many teams ride the coattails of the 2 or 3 great teams like the SEC. It just doesn't happen. I'm so tired of those coattail riding programs that are just chanting away and talking about how difficult and how great and all this when their records don't bear that out. That's not the case. It is false to say that the SEC top to bottom is better than every single conference. It is at the top end, but I don't know about top to bottom, in particular in the middle of that conference.
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's some things there that I agree with, and then some things where I'm like, okay, I'm not sure. Because like, if you're counting Iowa at the top of the conference, Iowa, I don't know if they'd come in. I don't know what place they would come in the SEC West, but they wouldn't win the division, all right? And they wouldn't come in second. So that's not a Bama thing. I see the Bama stuff where it's like Bama and then everybody else. And I go, okay, so we got Georgia back in the national championship game. And I'm like, how can you be that dismissive of the last non-Bama team to win it, having it be LSU, which is 2 years ago. It wasn't 20.
Yeah.
You know, because then I saw the other stuff where it's like, hey, look at the BCS and play. I'm like, we're counting Tennessee as an SEC team now that like is part of the national championship. So I push back on that. So sometimes I wonder, like, are we picking the arguments that we, because if you're hearing, hey, I expect this conference to go 12-0, you're going to be like, well, that's ridiculous. That's not what's happening. But then when they go 500 or just below with two teams in the national championship game,
yeah,
it's like, oh, I thought this conference was good. And I'm like, well, wait, what are we asking then for? Like Purdue, Tennessee has to pull that game against Purdue. Like, wait a minute, Kansas State playing a wide receiver, quarterback, for like that's a sick win. Like, what happens here? And I don't know how to keep track of it all.
I don't disagree with you. And I think what can also be difficult is defining the tiers that I talked about, right? I talked about like it has to be a conversation within the tier. When I say the top end of the conference, I say always, this is just me. I always just think of at maximum the top three teams, but generally the top two teams in the conference. That's your top tier. And that's Georgia and Alabama. And they are better than Ohio State and Michigan. What tends to happen is that when you get into these debates, right? So if we start debating the overall conference, you'll bring up Iowa, I'll bring up, you know, Florida or LSU and say, what happened against UCLA? And well, they weren't really bad. And so what you really start arguing is like, well, that team shouldn't be considered one of the top tier teams, even though Iowa, because of the stupid division format, actually played for a conference championship. They weren't even, at least in my estimation, a top three team in the Big Ten because of the imbalance in divisions.
Easily. So I mean, Ohio State, Michigan State, I don't think there's really much argument at this point with Iowa. So go ahead.
That's correct. But you get what I'm saying, right? So
yeah,
this is where those arguments at, and then you bring in these anecdotal things and you start to cross over what tier a team is in and what games that they played versus what opponents. We do have to say like Auburn lost to Penn State, and Penn State wasn't even really ranked all season long and wasn't getting a lot of respect because of the loss to an Illinois team. So we're kind of talking in circles here. I would just define it as this.
You did a good job with that.
Like, the SEC is the best conference at the top end, period, and has been for a decade or more. The middle of the conference, it's a really great conversation with the Big Ten. Because the Big Ten in the middle has done a pretty good job. And the middle of the SEC, at least this season, wasn't as good as we expected them to be.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Because I've had moments over the last few seasons where I go, going into this, I think the Big Ten has a chance to kind of be it'll be the first time I'll feel comfortable saying another conference is better than the SEC. I just think anybody that argues against the SEC, and maybe we're changing whatever the argument is, I go, you know, whether it's five teams playing for a title now, in this stretch, and A&M, who came in fifth last year, which should have been left out of the playoff, but still sniffing on it. If you had a season where, if you had, let me put it this way, if you had a decade where it was Ohio State, Penn State, Michigan State, Michigan, pick Iowa or Wisconsin, all playing for a national championship, none of us that think that it's this bias that exists that I hear
right.
spouted, do you think I would actually be dumb enough and want to ruin my credibility to come on a show on a Monday being like, yeah, I think it's still the South. I still think it's the SEC after we'd had five. I would never, ever do that. And that's where I think, like I thought at the end of the Michigan Big Ten championship game, I couldn't tell, and maybe you'll get pissed at me here, but I couldn't tell if Gus and you had it planned a little bit on how you want to talk about Michigan and Georgia, because it was like, hey, I think Georgia will be two. And then Gus was like fired up. He's like, wait a minute, that's bias. And I was like, wait a minute, here we go. I go, this feels a little like it was planned out a little bit. So I brought that up in my podcast.
I will tell you this. If I could plan things with Gus, that would be a win. But it's, you know, we don't talk about that stuff. That's something like that is not planned. Remember, he grew up in Detroit, right? And so Gus gets all bent out of shape, and I try to walk him off this ledge quite often, but he gets all bent out of shape about, these teams never play in the cold weather, man. You know, like he hates the fact that they don't come up and play in a game like we saw with Ohio State and Michigan, right? The snow falling, the cold weather, and things of that nature. It's part of what has made college football great. This fabric of college football is this argument. It has become regional and yet regional in a sense of pride, which makes it national because the regions are arguing against each other. But no, to answer your question, we had not talked about it. In fact, I don't remember exactly what was said at the end of the game. I know we were talking about seeding and what he thought was going to happen.
And you said, hey, it's going to be Bama, and then it'll be Georgia, and then it'll be Michigan. And then he was like, why is it going to be Michigan third behind Georgia? He's like, that's Joel. That's bias. And I was like, here we go.
He was mad. He did not want Michigan to play Georgia. Because let's be really honest. This thing played out in the best possible scenario for the SEC. The best possible scenario. Alabama beating Georgia in the SEC championship game played out perfectly for them because they got two teams in. If Georgia wins, they don't get two teams. Like,
no, Bama's
I know
not
people,
in.
They, yeah. I don't think Bama is in. I don't know exactly who was going to go, whether it would be Notre Dame sneaking in there or how they were going to manufacture it. Oklahoma State would have gone if they would have gotten the pylon in the Big 12 championship game, but they didn't. So it worked out beautifully. And then you also get this matchup, which is going to favor you, where both of your teams get in and both of them miss each other. So they're going to beat these other two teams, Cincinnati and Michigan. I firmly believe that this worked out as well as it possibly could. And that's where people outside of the SEC footprint start getting really frustrated. They're like, oh, of course, this is going to happen again. It seems to always happen for them. And yeah, they get the benefit of the doubt, but they've also earned the benefit of the doubt, in particular at the top end of the conference. But I don't plan those conversations with Gus. Okay. I wish we could.
I think Gus was ready. He was like, if Michigan rolls in this game, I'm going to make sure I get this in. I get this across. And by the way, maybe I should correct myself being so dismissive of a two-loss Bama, because if it had been a close loss to Georgia, you know, who knows? Maybe the committee goes, they're still better than Notre Dame. They're still better than Oklahoma State if Oklahoma State was able to pull that game out. What else did I have for you here? Because this is the part of the geography of it that isn't even the SEC. Ohio State's the only team in the last 16 years that I wouldn't describe as a Southern football team to win a title. Mm. Because if you throw Clemson in there, where Clemson's run is somehow, well, we know why. Like, Clemson's run doesn't get enough credit because of what Bama's done. Clemson's run is one of the great runs in the history of the sport. It just happens to coincide with the best of all time. So, you know, you throw Auburn in the mix, you throw Florida State in there, Clemson. I mean, this, do you see this as a problem? Do you see it maybe, you know, not a year-to-year interest, but planting the seed for a 20 to 15 year loss of interest out on the West Coast or maybe some of the mountain regions? I'm certainly not Texas, but this is a pretty dominant geographical run.
I mean, to say the least, there's no doubt. And I would love to be smart enough to have better answers for this, but I think that there's a lot of factors. I think that this is a multi-factor analysis. I think that you can talk about the overall migration of our society to the South. I've heard people argue, and I think it's actually a really smart point. As air conditioning has gotten cheaper, it's become easier and easier to live in the South, and you can avoid the winter, and that's why populations in the South have exploded. And so all of a sudden, you just have a denser population and recruiting footprint in the South. I mean, I've heard that argument, and I can't dismiss that, right? Like, that seems to be fair. There's very fertile recruiting grounds in the southern United States. And I think that one of the factors that you can talk about just within the sport is that the lack of financial success on the West Coast has opened up the recruiting nationally, in particular from teams from the South, to go out and get into Texas and then into California. And that's something that you didn't see a lot of. In particular, like when I was playing, you didn't see the SEC teams going into Texas and getting the best recruits in Texas. You never saw anybody go in and get the best recruits from Southern California and the California area and get them out of the footprint there. When I was playing, Oklahoma and Texas owned the state of Texas. Nobody came in there, right? I mean, the Big 12 was the Big 12. Alabama wasn't getting in there. Nick Saban hadn't come yet. In fact, Les Miles had just left from Oklahoma State and gone down to LSU. And so it didn't feel as national as it does now in terms of recruiting. But then all of a sudden, You had the Big 12 kind of disband. And then now Nebraska, which is a normally a power, is not recruiting Texas very well. And then you let the SEC into Texas. Now their footprint expands into one of the most fertile recruiting bases. Then USC falls off the map and everybody goes in and starts poaching Southern California kids. And so now all of a sudden you take the South, which is already a very good recruiting base. You say, hey, the ACC is not doing quite as well revenue-wise, so those teams are going to go down just a little bit. So now you've got all of Florida, you've got Texas, and you can go poach California. Plus, you still have that Atlanta, Georgia area, which produces a lot of great talent. And you can see why the SEC has become so big, so powerful, and so dominant over this era. Their recruiting is just second to none at this point, and I think it's because they have access to every fertile recruiting ground in the country.
Let's end on this because I know you've talked about it. I don't know if you've pivoted at all because I know that I have a bit. I think that's kind of trying to keep up with college football, having an open mind about some of the things that we want. I don't know how much I love the idea of expansion. I know that it's going to happen and I'm okay with it when it does. I just don't love some of the arguments that we're opening ourselves up to for teams where it's like, wait, you had a chance and now you got like a 3-loss team and you think you have a chance at like an 8 seed in this whole thing. Like that's just something I'm not looking forward to. But I'll get through it. The playoff part of this is weird because it was like, hey, here's the plan. It's like, oh, by the way, it's not the plan. And none of us, we're just not on the same page because now we have this alliance here that's anti-SEC and ACC. It's weird because the more you dig in and kind of ask people about college football, it's like, yeah, maybe people didn't really have it as locked in as we thought with these imminent changes. Changes will happen. The timeline seems to be delayed. Where are you now with all the different stuff that you've heard in your travels? I'm sure access to great information on what they'd like to have happen, but it's always hard to get everybody on the same page.
It is. I have also evolved on the playoff. I don't know if we ever had that discussion, but I used to be... I don't want to say vehemently, but I was against expansion.
From 4 to 8 or 4 to 12? Just beyond correct. 4. Okay. All right.
I mean, even going to 4, I had, I was like, guys, I don't know, because my whole argument was that the most unique and special thing about college football that was different than every other sport on the planet was the uniqueness and importance of the regular season. And I was hanging my hat on that. And I thought, man, the expansion into a playoff format, it's going to ding the regular season a little bit. I don't know if I'm in favor of that. I have come off of that position. And it's because we have shoved all the oxygen in the sport into 4 spots. And that's not good for the sport. Okay, so we created a problem with the new playoff that we need to go and we need to fix. So that doesn't mean that expansion overall is the best thing that could ever happen for college football. But it does mean that based on what it is now, there needs to be some fixes. And when I say shove all the oxygen, I mean all the importance, all the meaning, the definition of success only is determined by those 4 spots. See, in past years, like I've talked with Barry Alvarez about this. And I've talked about, you know, Barry, I don't know if what you did at Wisconsin is available to anybody now. Which means he went to a program that was not very good at Wisconsin, and he built them into a power using incremental definitions of success. Getting to 500 meant something. Getting to a bowl game meant something. Getting to a New Year's Day bowl game meant something. Getting to a Rose Bowl meant something. And it meant something that could define you as successful in the pantheon of the sport, not just for you and your own fan base, but it's like this meant something to everybody in the sport. And now that's not necessarily afforded for everybody because if you're not in the playoff, it's not deemed a success. Ask Ohio State fans right now. They would not deem their season a success. And so because of that, we have this separation of the classes where only the top 5, 6 teams in the country are getting all the best recruits and they're going to continue to separate themselves out. And then everybody else is going to be suffering. And I think that allowing some opportunity for a definition of success for more teams, whether they're going to win a national championship or not, you need to have that definition of success at least afforded to them through an expanded playoff. They also need revenue badly. After COVID, revenue is going to be a big part of this thing. And I know no one wants to talk about revenue, but they need to expand revenue. And in particular, in places like the ACC and in the Pac-12 to try to remain competitive with the conferences that are right now driving a lot of revenue like the Big Ten. And the SEC. now when you get into just like the formation of what could potentially take place, this is where there's a lot of argument happening. I firmly believe that Greg Sankey wants what's best for the sport. Having said that, he's incentivized to act in his own best interest, just as Kevin Warren is and George Golovkov and Jim Phillips and Bob Bowlsby. It's one of the problems with the sport is that everybody within the sport at the power level is operating in their own best interest, and there's very few people operating with the interest of the entirety in mind. Having said that, we're going to argue, or these guys are going to argue about very small differences. For instance, right now, there is an argument between, hey, do we want to include automatic bids for conference champions, or do we just want to say the six best champions? Now, you and I might think to ourselves like, well, there's no difference between the two. But they are legitimately arguing, like there's an impasse over that language of, are we taking automatic bursts? Are we talking the six best? And because of that, people just folded their arms and are like, well, we can't move forward. So it might be a longer process than we think, but it ultimately will happen. We will expand. And I think that it'll be good for college football, at least in relation to what I was just, chatting about, which was just the overall importance of the meaning of success in our sport.
Yeah, because I always push back about like, okay, so this team's going to be in there. They're going to get a chance to play for a championship when I'm like, okay, we're going to have 1 year at least where there's of the five automatic bids of the Power Fives, say, and then the sixth is to the group of five. There's going to be somebody to be like, wait, that team's in there for a championship? Like that conference is completely down or whatever. But then again, I'll look at some of the numbers, which I think are a bit cyclical here. But the 4-1 matches, some of these matches we had in the playoffs have been absolutely blowouts in a very short amount of history. Of
totally.
So it's like, totally. Okay, so you have this system and we have blowouts. So you're just worried about blowouts in a different system. I do kind of like the idea, though, of people feeling like things are not against them all the time. And I still can't believe that all the power brokers would agree on something where it's like, hey, you know, at least two or three of us, or excuse me, one or two of us are getting screwed out of the playoff money, right? Is that what we want to agree on? Okay, cool. Because that's what we just agreed on. Last thing before I let you go, because I forgot about it, and I know you got to run here. Harbaugh, what if he bounces?
Oh, gosh. It's been so new. I just read about this yesterday. I had not thought about it. Jim seems pretty happy. You know, I was around them. I think I did five or six of their games. He seems pretty happy. He brought in a lot of these guys on his staff that he's comfortable with. That I think that there was something different about that whole program this year. I would be pretty surprised if he left. Having said that, he's had success every single place that he's been. You cannot argue with that, by the way. There are a lot of detractors from Jim Harbaugh. You cannot make an argument that he doesn't succeed wherever he goes. And from an NFL owner standpoint, that's going to be very appealing. Is that he can come in and probably have success with your roster. Now, whether he's going to have long-term success or not, I think remains to be seen. But he certainly is going to turn any organization or program around that he's involved with. Having said that, I don't think he's driven by money. This is not a leverage play for a new contract, or else he wouldn't be donating all of his bonus money back to the program like he is with all the bonus money that he renegotiated with. If you don't know, he renegotiated. He took half the salary. Everything was incentive-based. So he made basically like, I think it's between $2 and $3 million in incentives this year because of their great run to the playoff. He's donating all of that back to the program. I've never felt like this guy is motivated by money, which means that I just don't see it, but I could be wrong. I mean, that's pure speculation on my part. I think that he'll be the coach at Michigan next year.
It's Joel Klatt, Breaking the Huddle, Wednesday night, FS1, 9:30 Pacific time. And then he'll be, again, a part of the National Championship Live tailgate on the night of the title game. That'll be on Fox Sports and CFB on Fox digital platforms. I've enjoyed you all season for multiple seasons. I'm glad we finally get a chance to do this. Thanks, Joel.
No doubt. And listen, I will be more accessible in the future. I was even telling somebody here, they were like, New Year's resolution. I was like, I'm going to become a better texter. I'm the worst. I'm terrible at returning text. So there you go.
Well, don't beat up on yourself. It's a new year. Thank you, Joel.
See you, bud.
This episode is brought to you by Vuori. It's time to ditch your old workout fits. Seriously, just let them go and try Vuori clothing instead. Their activewear is unbelievable. Sometimes I wear it and I go, do I look too good? I don't want to be at this peak level of awesomeness in their joggers every single day, this is going to be hard to maintain. But that's what the joggers do for you, whether you're sort of business cash, whether you're just around the house, whether you're working out, whether you're getting on a plane and you're going to be in your seat for a long time. The joggers just give you a hug for the entire flight. It's soft. It's comfortable. You're never going to want to take them off. Incredible versatility. You can wear it while taking part in different kinds of exercises, running, training, swimming, yoga, and more. Vuori yoga class? That just makes sense. The Sunday jogger is the number one go-to. And of course, the core short out now. Get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet. Our listeners get 20% off their first purchase at Vuori.com/Ryan, R-Y-E-N. That's Vuori.com/Ryan. This episode is brought to you by Modelo. Modelo knows it's not about whether you win or lose. It's about cheering louder, traveling further. It's about showing up no matter what, because you are a fighter and Modelo is your reward. An ice cold reward, rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Modelo, the mark of a fighter. Shop delivery or pickup options near you at ordermodelo.com. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
You want details? Fine. I drive a Ferrari 355 Cabriolet. What's up? I have a ridiculous house in the South Fork. I have every toy you can possibly imagine. And best of all, kids, I am liquid. So, now you know what's possible. Let me tell you what's required.
Life advice. Before I do that, new show, documentary, four parts, I think. I probably shouldn't do this until I've watched the entire thing, because I don't know how it's going to end. But the line about this Navy SEAL team, it's on Apple TV. It's unbelievable. I don't know how many of you watched Restrepo or Red War by the author Sebastian Younger, who did Perfect Storm. War was one of the best war books I've ever read, so immediately wanted to watch Restrepo. That was like as real a documentary, at least on, you know, those guys were in the mountain ranges of Afghanistan. I mean, look, you don't need to be told, hey, that would suck to be part of that deployment. Like, yeah, the gear is cool and I want to be a tough guy. I think a lot of men, you know, you grow up, you kind of think like, oh, I wonder what that would be like, you know? Maybe some don't. You know, I'm sure plenty are like, fuck that. I would want nothing to do with that. I don't know. I think there's always been a part of me that would be like, wonder what that would be like. Well, how would you, like, yeah, I guess I'll just admit it. I'll ask myself, like, how would you handle that in the moment? Like, would you be losing your shit or would you be steady? Would you figure out a way to get through it? I have no idea. I think there are times you would almost want to know. And then you watch those and be like, no, I'm good. Like, I don't want to know the answer because it's awful. And watching this thing about the SEAL team in Afghanistan and the SEAL team leader and this whole thing, I'm two parts into it. So full endorsement of that show on Apple TV, if you have Apple TV. We do have a 20-year debate going on, my friend group, of what would you rather do, be in jail or be at war? And I mean, I would much rather be at war. There's a few guys that pick jail, though, and I'm like, you guys are out of your minds. But
I mean, I think the answer is definitely jail. What, you get meals, like you get your own bed and cot. It's nice and cozy. You know, I mean, you're probably bored out of your mind. Yeah, it's somewhat dangerous, but it's not as dangerous as
you think. You think you get a little bored in jail, you think?
I mean, but like, I'd rather be bored than like dodging bullets in Afghanistan.
For me, it's not even, there's no way. There's no fucking way.
You need
way.
To be stimulated. Yeah, right.
I'd be like, no. I'm just like, I don't care.
No, here's the thing. Are you trained? Like, are you like, do you know what you're doing at war? Or are you, or is it you at war that like, hey, here's a, you know, AR, figure it out.
You know,
I'll blend it in jail.
This debate has gone on for so long because the guys that pick war can't believe the guys that pick jail, and the guys that pick jail can't believe the guys that pick war. So I think there's a moderate understanding that you would be trained.
Okay.
Yeah. Kyle, you're a war guy, right? Over jail?
I wanted to be an MP guarding some sort of stuff in Spain where nothing was ever going to pop off. That was my, in high school, that's what I wanted to do. But
what was the inspiration for that rewarding?
It just seemed like nothing was ever going to pop off. It seemed like, well, you know, there's only so many ways to get a pension. I want to, you know, be enjoying my life by the time I'm, you know, cresting into my 50s. So it'd be nice to just be taken care of if I could just put in, you know, 20 years fresh out of high school. That would have been kind of a dream. But I ended up not doing that.
Okay, we got a couple things going on here. One is you. That's so not you, though. Like, you're not a narc.
And then you were no. Well, not a cop. Like, an MP is like, I understood it was like a guy who like guards something. Like, you're not necessarily looking for drugs or something. You're just kind of maybe guarding some shipping containers in a Spanish dock or somewhere in Hawaii. I don't know. That's what I thought. It was like, I don't know. My recruiter was very zealous and overzealous and told me, you know, he was going to show me the world like Aladdin or something. But I ended up not doing it. So it's fine.
So you went through the recruiting process to potentially be an MP at docks in Hawaii or Spain?
In my head, that's what I was going to do. Yeah. Well, I took the test and they were like, yeah, man, you could do anything. I was like, okay, I feel like you probably tell a lot of people that. But the ASVAB or whatever, it was like, it said it worked out really well. It was like, yeah, you can pretty much, you're qualified for anything.
Like, okay. You have unlimited potential.
I was like, I got a 75 in math. There's no way I'm qualified for everything, but thanks.
Guys, like, do you want to be a tech, a sniper, or a doc guy? You're like, doc guy.
All right. Where's the boats, dude?
So what's going on with this filter? You have a mask that's a fake mask on your Zoom filter, and it's...
Well, you know, I like to test them out. I like to test a different thing, but guess who's got COVID? Probably me. Still haven't gotten my thing back, but about 3 days ago, I took a test, but I've been feeling like shit. My girlfriend tested positive, so, I mean, one would surmise I have COVID.
Okay, can we stop testing it? Because it's driving me crazy, this filter.
What do you mean?
I kind of love it.
Actually, no. I think it's going to have to stay now.
Okay. All right. I got overruled. That's fair.
The next life advice, you'll get a different one.
I hate looking at it. And so we're going to have to, Saruti, can you take a picture of this at some point and just say this is what Kyle brought to the table on a Friday? I don't like it, but I have some dictator tendencies on the podcast. This will not be a time.
I'm going to start adjusting it. I'm gonna start fake adjusting it.
The thing is we have one life advice that's so good, and I can't wait to have Kyle chime in on it, that I almost want to see the full Kyle. But that's fine. This is your call. It's your filter, your rules.
Thanks.
Okay. All right, first one is I don't know, maybe you guys can help me out with this one. Okay. 6'2", 195, can play a mean ukulele. That's probably a fun instrument to be able to just... It's getting late. I'm like, hey, break out your ukulele. All right. Girlfriend and I started serious conversations about moving in together this year. I need some advice on how much would be fair to charge her for rent. Uh-oh. Background. Kyle's just like, what's the debate? It's 50-50. Sometimes a little more complicated than that, as our man explains. I own a 3-bedroom house in a large city, can currently cover the $2,600 a month mortgage comfortably with my budget. She currently lives in a 1-bedroom apartment about 15 minutes away, and her rent is in the $1,500, $2,000 a month range. We both make about the same salary, so no personal finance discrepancies they're not really an issue. Obviously, utilities and such would be split 50-50. Okay, so utilities, 50-50, but that would only come out to her chipping in a couple $100. A complete 50-50 split on the mortgage feels like too much, since her portion is ultimately getting invested back into my house's equity, but I also don't want to get totally taken advantage of by asking for peanuts. I keep coming back to an easy all-in flat rate of $1,000 a month because we both see decent monthly housing expense relief at that amount. Okay. But that still feels steep at $1,000. Maybe those feelings are just from being a product of Midwestern parents. Oh, look at this. What would you do? I'm sure plenty of folks are going through the same scenario. So general cohabitation financial advice is greatly appreciated. Would love to hear Saruti and Kyle's take as well. Y'all are the best. I love the Midwestern values here thing, because I think what we're talking about here is a guy who's a bit old-fashioned and feels like if he's going to be the man in the relationship, he has the home, he's providing shelter, and that it's not a stretch for him to cover the $2,600 that he's already done on his own, that he would like to provide for a person that he cares about a lot. I am probably still a little old-fashioned in those ways, despite never having to have this conversation with anybody. I've thought it out in my head, and certainly how you are doing financially as the provider. And again, this could be flipped if the female provider has the house and she's doing better than the guy she cares about and sees a future and a family together. And you just start to adapt and make some concessions that should be... you know, not influenced on like, am I getting fucked on the rent? Oh, it's just 60-40 split's actually bullshit. You know, like if you want to marry somebody and have kids with them, You're really going to let 60-40 ruin your day? Now, some people listening to this would say, absolutely, that's bullshit. Maybe some others are listening to this, our older listeners. We do have older listeners that are going, nah, man, like if that's going to be your wife, she's going to be having kids, which is, I think, where you're hinting at this going, then you should provide for her. I like where your head's at. I don't think you need any advice from us whatsoever. You don't want to charge her that much, but you want to charge her something. A lot of it comes down to how will you presenting this impact the relationship? Because I would say others, you know, there'll be some women that you'd be dating that would be like, this is great. No problem. I want to feel like I'm kicking in towards the house's equity that's going to become our house. And there'd be some women that are like, you're lucky you're getting 50-50 on the utilities. It's your house. I'm moving in. We'll see how it goes while they're pocketing all their savings. It really depends on the other person and how they see this. I think your head is in the right place. I would bring it up. And if you feel like there's no pushback to $1,000, you could just say, hey, look, you want to do $1,000 until we figure out taking the next step? And if she's totally cool with it, you don't feel like there's any tension and she's not lying to you, then go ahead and do it. If you want to charge her less because it makes you feel better because you know that she's going to be really important to you, then go ahead and do that. But really, it's going to come down to like where you think that comfort zone is for her feeling like you're actually in agreement and you're not just saying out loud what sounds like an agreement, which will lead to like, if she says yes to a deal she doesn't like, she's telling her friends, and then 6 months later, all this animosity is building up where it's turning into like, yeah, the fucking guy's charging me $1,000 on top of everything else. You know, it's not like we're not going to get married. Now, there was a different situation where it's just somebody you're living with and you're not sure if you're going to get married. I think the rules are different there, but I think your heart and your head are in the right place. And it sounds like you're probably even going to go under $1,000 because of whatever guilt that you have as a Midwestern salt of the earth type of guy. And that's really up to you. But I don't really think you need our advice. I think you mapped it out pretty well. Kyle, I feel like you're going to go in another direction on this one.
I'm not. I think you're right. 1,000 is a good square number. Now that I understand the situation, you're not splitting a rent for nothing, for something you won't own. And when it's all done, you know, people paid X amount of dollars and you move on. Like this, I get this. This makes sense. But $1,000 is a good square number. She's getting a break on what she had before. And honestly, if she has a problem with that, honestly, she's a bit unreasonable. And it's good that you're doing this test drive before you move to the next step. So I think that's great. I think she's saving money. She's going to be living in a house that, you know, maybe she'll have some input on stuff, like not necessarily that she's going to start painting walls and changing cabinets and shit, but I'm just saying, like, maybe she'll feel like she has a little bit of, you know, she feel like she could try to improve it with you, and maybe, you know, that it's just $1,000 would be well spent for her if she thinks this is going to work out. And also it's saving her money, and especially if you're making kind of the same amount of money, it'd be weird if you were taking a large portion of your income and she was taking none of it to put towards living situation. I think 1,000 is a great number, and I wouldn't do anything else if that works. Then just stop there. No need to think about it. It's a great job.
Yeah, I think if she doesn't want to contribute, that's a bit of a red flag for you. So, and I think, like you said, $1,000 is a good number. And, you know, she should probably know too. And I don't know how you necessarily broach this with her, but like, you know, she's going to eventually get that money back if you guys get engaged and married. It's not like she's throwing that money to rent. Like, she's giving that money to you, which is then building you guys equity. So I don't know how exactly you have that conversation with her, because that is like the logical person to me saying you're not actually losing money here. In the long term, you're actually probably just giving the money to me, which is then your money in our same bank account. So I don't know the eloquent way to have that conversation, but that would be the logic.
Yeah. I mean, he does say, hey, it's a girlfriend. We're having this serious moving conversation. We'll see where this goes. So maybe, you know, everything that I'm talking about, marriage and kids and the future down the road, maybe that's not even there yet. I would think it is, if you're taking this step, that it's a possible option and an option that you probably both hope that happens. But I would not be a hardliner on this one ever. You know, even if I weren't doing that well, I don't know. I just think there are certain times, and again, this is, I feel like I'm a little bit more old fashioned, where it's like, if I'm going to be making more money and bringing money back, and I already have a place that I live in, and I care about you, and I want you to be in my life, then I'm not going to get fucking worked up about a split. I actually think that's where people lose their minds about stuff. I'm sure there are people listening to us right now going, no way, no, it's an understanding, it's an agreement, doesn't mean anything's going to work out. So why are you going to get taken? I'm not saying get taken here. I'm saying just come up with something where you feel like you're actually out loud being honest with each other about the arrangement, and a couple $100 swing here and there. I mean, who gives a shit? We're talking about a potential life partner here, and making sure that that part of the relationship is more secure than you wondering if you're losing a couple $100 every month. I mean, I don't know. I remember I had a roommate situation where a guy let me sublet in. You know, I was pretty desperate for a living situation at that point. This is kind of part whatever of all the shit that I talk about in the past. But his girlfriend basically lived in the house with us. And then one of my friends was like, hey, are you doing the rent three ways? Are you doing the utility? And I was just like, nah. I was like, whatever, dude. You know, like, I don't, she's cool. We all get along. They helped me move in. Like, I'm just, and again, maybe I'm a pushover for that, some of that stuff, but I've also lived with other people that are insane about utilities and splits and to the dollar and the phone bill and did you do this one and all this different stuff. And you look back on it, you go, it's a lot of stress that didn't mean anything. It just didn't mean anything. And a couple bucks here or there over the course of your life, you know, my goal is to not in every one of those negotiations in my entire life to be up big. Like, you know what, I didn't
win
throw
the deal.
In for this. Yeah. I didn't throw in for this bottle service. And there was a time where I won two credit card roulettes here. And there was also another time where I got a better hotel room, but we all paid even. So I was up there. Like, honestly, guys like that in your friend group, and they exist. I've got a couple. Just like, who the fuck's keeping, when is this game over? Like, when do you win it?
Imagine your friend group, like, you know, you're talking about it and you're like, yeah, you know, she wanted to pay 800, but I was really hard about 1,000. She's paying me $1,000 a month. Like, what's the response? Like, cool, dude. Like, congrats. That's awesome, man. $200 a month for your girlfriend.
I think we've handled that one. What did you do with Maddie Cerruti? How long did you guys live together before you were engaged?
Well, so we lived in an apartment for a couple years before we got engaged, and then we bought a house before we got engaged. But I mean, we kind of knew where it was going. And then I proposed when we closed on the house. So we were actually never, you know, in the house, not engaged, but we went into the process not being engaged, and it was really never a conversation. We were just like, we're just gonna split it 50-50, and that's what we did.
Was there any pushback on, like, we can't live together until we're engaged? You weren't doing that kind of stuff, right?
No, sort of happened, right? No, my dad is a hard, like, you should live with someone before you before you're willing to commit to them for the rest of your life, which is the best advice you can give to anybody. I don't honestly, I know there are different things that people and values and whatnot, but it's just the most no-brainer thing to me. Like, how would you?
It's the most no-brainer. It's seriously one of the most no-brainer things ever. I can't believe that people do it. I dated
somebody. What value would that be that prevented you from doing that? Like, well, what value? Would you have to be Amish?
Like, I grew up like, you know, going to Catholic mass, right? And there was, I don't know, that was back in like the 90s, right? There was like some frowning upon that, but I feel like that quickly changed in the last like decade.
Yeah, you weren't supposed to Google boobs according to them either. Yeah. But I mean, who didn't do that?
Cosmic Googling boob.
On the family computer and then freaking out because I never taught myself how to clear the Google search bar. So if you typed in B, it was a problem. I figured it out eventually.
Good for you. Do you live with a lot of women, Kyle?
Well, I live with a single mom. Are we talking like romantically or what?
Actually, I just want to know about you living with a single mom, because you're going to be fucking kidding me.
No, my mom was single, I mean.
Oh, all right. Okay. That one makes way more sense.
I can understand how many life advices we've gone down weird roads, so I can understand why you thought that. But no, the person, the woman I live with now is the only one I've ever actually moved in with. So
nice.
So it's so far going well. But there's women in my life, Ryan. What do you want me to say?
That's like what is it? Is it grandpa's boy? Or what the hell's, what's that?
Grandma's boy?
Grandma's boy. Grandma's boy. Yeah. When it's Swartzen, right? And he goes, he's like, oh, you guys mean, like, you guys should come back, my roommates. They're like, your grandmother?
Correct.
Like, they're not your, like, oh, sorry. That's such a great line in his
delivery. Check with my roommates first. Yeah.
Let me just check with my roommates first, dude. He's, Nick Swartzen delivering a line and almost anything's a win. You know, whenever he's like, okay. Actually, we were DMing at one point. I think we were trying to get him on. Obviously, that didn't work out. Big Timberwolves fan, from what I remember. I'm a little upset with Kilbourne. He's been at like 3 Timberwolves games here at the what used to be known as the Staples Center. And I don't know. But yeah, I think he's sitting courtside. See, those are not invites. You don't get those invites, the courtside invites. But we're, you know what? We'll plant the seed in his head. Next time Timberwolves are in town. That's even going to happen. All right. I have one here. I'm not going to read any other ones because let's end Friday on a note here where I, This one's just ridiculous. Buckle up, folks. 5'7", 190. Not fat, but not yoked either. My parents are both from Greece, so I like to think I'm built like a bulky Mike Tolbert-esque Greek statue.
It's just like thick European Mike dudes. Nice.
Yeah. Like, you know who that guy's torso looks like? Mike Tolbert's. To give you some background, I'm a senior in college where I once played a sport but hung up the cleats. I make good grades. In fact, parentheses, not to sound like a douche. I have a job in investment banking lined up after graduation.
Nice.
Hey, time out real quick. If you have an awesome job lined up in investment banking and you want to do it and you're like apologizing that there's a chance you're going to make insane money in 10 years, if it works out, don't apologize for that. All right. The way we look at success now and criticize it is very weird. And so I would say to everybody listening, if you have a good setup, and again, it's not a guarantee that it's going to work out here, but if you want to be an investment banker because it could be fucking awesome for you financially and you want that life, go for it. Good for you. Don't apologize about it. Okay. He also likes to just do normal college stuff, hang out, watch sports, drink beers. Anyway, I began dating this girl at school about a year and a half ago. I remember the second I laid eyes on her as a freshman, I knew she was the one. I hope this guy doesn't get busted for this. Or at least that way we'll know it's real. After a couple of years of putting in work, this guy put in some effort. I finally began dating her. For the most part, things have been great. She's everything I want in a girl. Cool, funny, athletic, and beautiful. Sometimes she can be a bit bossy, and my boys like to give me shit by saying she wears the pants or calling me a simp or whatever, but I don't really mind because I really care about her. I got to say, first read through on this one, the Greek part saved me from even reading it. All right, here we go. Because it was so specific. However, we recently have gotten into a disagreement stemming from things in the bedroom. Started after the night of a party. We went back to my house. It was late. My four housemates were all home. So that means we're living in we get a domicile, five dudes, four roommates. You and your lady come back home after a big night out. Me and my girlfriend came home and had sex in my room. The next morning, she left and things were fine until my housemates started giving me a hard time, saying they could hear her repeated spanking noises from my room. Kyle liked that one. Apparently, that wasn't the first time they heard it either. To make matters worse, one of my housemates' girlfriends was also over that night, and she heard it too. A few days go by. Next thing I know, all these girls in my friend circle get word of the spanking noises from my room, and it gets back to my girlfriend. Obviously, my girlfriend is super embarrassed and upset, but she is most upset with me and not my housemate's girlfriend, who told everyone. The problem is the spanking noises did come from us, but it was not her on the receiving end. Look, I know this sounds super suspect. It does, because it's so well written, but maybe you're going to be a great investment banker because you can get your point across. I know it sounds super suspect. I've been with other girls and nobody's ever done this besides her. He did say she was bossy.
Right.
And it's not like she does this every time. It's just when we're drinking. At first, I thought it was a little weird, but harmless and not very aggressive, so I didn't say anything. Over time, I suppose it has escalated a bit. Not to a crazy painful level or anything, but... But since it only happens when I'm drunk, I guess I just don't really care. Besides, she's my girlfriend, and I really like her, so I want to make her happy. All caps. However, now she is saying I have until the end of the month to tell my housemates it was not her who got spanked.
Or what? Man. Or what? I'd call you on that.
This is where I'm like, I don't know. It's... I almost didn't read it, not because of the content, because I'm just like how well it's crafted. But you know what? A lot of things checked out. I did a little research, so I think it's real.
This isn't any movie that I've heard of, so I think we're good on that thing.
Season 9 of Always Sunny in Philadelphia, right? I know this is something my friends will never let go. Yep, they're not gonna. Plus, I'm worried about everyone else will hear about it too. I try to explain to her this is way more embarrassing for me than it would be for her, but she says that's just my toxic masculinity speaking.
Oh, come on. See what you mean now. I see what you mean.
And I really liked her. And if I really... Okay, so she said that's just my toxic masculinity speaking. And if I really liked her, I would defend her by telling the truth. She's been super cold to me recently. He's barely talked to me the last few days. We rarely fight, and I've never seen her this mad. What should I do? Is there any way I can make things right with her without having to embarrass myself? Or am I going to have to swallow my pride and come clean? Okay. I was with you trying to find a resolution until she said, if this is true, all right, if she thinks that you telling your buddies, hey, I am actually the guy getting spanked in there that you all heard, and every time you hear it, it's me getting spanked, and you don't feel like dealing with it as a college kid, that's one of the most understandable things ever, and that's not toxic masculinity. So the fact that she would, again, if this actually happened, if she countered your argument, like, hey, it sucks way more for me than it would for you, so can we just let this thing go? And she says, no, it's your toxic masculinity. I would break up on the fucking spot right there. I don't care how long you, obviously, this is something that's very Tupac above the rim for you. That's cool and all. Appreciate your effort for 2 years, which probably could, no offense, call you a simp for that alone. You said she was bossy. Your friend's like, she kind of wears the pants. And so I would, at this stage of my life, you know, you get a little bit older, you give less of a shit around you. It's not like you know, I think it's just a certain age. You probably don't have four dude roommates. Then you might just say, yeah, man, what's up? That's my deal. What's up now? You know, but at this stage, if you don't feel comfortable, like, you know, if we really want to get like the deep end of this, the fact that it's your toxic masculinity, but if she cares about you, she couldn't actually see it your way and understand that this is how you're reacting and your feelings are thus, and therefore she can't like understand and accept those things. And it's just about you being a man that doesn't want to admit he's been spanked by his girlfriend at their house with four other dude college guys. If she can't understand that, I wouldn't date her. That's probably not what you're going to do because you've been in love with this girl for so long. But I would say this. Who would ever want to be in a relationship, except for psychopaths, where you would never want the other person to ever push back on anything, right? Like, I wouldn't want to date somebody. Like, I know I'm going to kind of do things my way, right? I think that's pretty evident at this point in my life. But I wouldn't, like, if I cared about somebody and they were in it for the long haul, you also need that person to kind of call you on your stuff a little bit. There needs to be some pushback. There needs to be some fight back. And if she's constantly running this and you're never allowed to have any pushback whatsoever, that's not very healthy for you. And it kind of makes her look weird. So look, I'm on your side. I would tell her straight up, hey, this is going to end the relationship if you're telling me that it's my toxic masculinity that is the reason why I don't, as a college kid, like, I don't feel like dealing with this. Now, you could just sit back and say, hey, I got one more semester. But yeah, you're going to be, I don't know. I mean, it's not the worst thing to ever have said about a dude. So I wouldn't worry about that all that much. But I don't know. I don't think. I don't even know how this could be one of those things where generationally, as I'm saying this stuff out loud, people are like, oh no, in 2022, Russell, you have to absolutely own this. And I would just be like, okay, well then I'm psyched I'm not in college right now because there's no way. There's no way college me at 21 would be like,
stepping up to the plate.
Yeah.
For this.
Like, yeah. Come like, on. Hey, I know you like doing that to me. That's fine because it's behind, you know, it's our little deal. It's not that big of a deal. Okay, whatever. Although now that I think about it, there's a bunch of guys I know that would have been like, yeah, I don't care. Fuck it. Yeah, I get spanked up. She likes to spank me. What's up? I don't know. Go ahead, Kyle. Take it.
I mean, I started out initially thinking that of like, but you just shouldn't have to. You shouldn't have to be like, hey, just wanted to clear something up. I'm the one who's on the receiving end of the spanks. So as long as we're good, if you can just go tell everybody you know so we can get this cleared up, that's great.
Spread the word.
Yeah. My advice is operating from you're going to do nothing. My advice isn't like, what should you do? I'm saying, well, how should you navigate doing nothing about this is all I'm saying. Is because, I don't think anybody really, most people don't end up with anybody from school, whether that be college or high school. I guess college has probably a higher success rate. But like, you're about to be an investment banker, dude. See where that life takes you. You already know what ticket you have for this ride. It's obviously not going to be great. I mean, and the other thing is if she can't understand that when you step into a five-person college house, like, you should be happy if that's the only thing that happens to you. Like, honestly, anything goes, like, your stuff gets broken, you know, just stuff happens. So like the fact that like this is out of your control and she wants you, you just kind of have to charge it to the game at this point. If she doesn't understand that, it sounds like she's a senior. She should have been around a few college houses to know that like you're not safe there. It's definitely not one of the safer places. So I don't know. I just think I just think you should do. You said you like to drink beer and talk sports and hang out. And I think you should continue to do that. Run out her clock and see what the fuck happens. Because at the end of the day, you're going to be an investment banker. You're almost done with school. And it sounds like, you know, you're stressed out about this and you're never going to get these years back. And I don't think you should have to cap it off by, you know, telling everyone you get spanked so somebody else feels better. That's weird. So, yeah,
charge,
just continue.
Charge do it to the game is what Kyle said.
Yeah, just do. Keep doing you. Keep doing you.
It's not about admitting, you know, it's not about the kink shaming or admitting that you're the one being spanked. To me, it's about what else is she going to ask you to take the fall for later in life? You know, like this is like the first step of something that could be like problematic in the rest of your relationship. Like, is she going to ask you to like take the blame for like car accidents in the future or like random shit at work? Like, who knows? And you don't want to be dealing with that stuff, especially as Kyle said, if you're like this young budding investment banker who has his whole future ahead of him.
But we don't know that. It could also not work out too.
It could all come crashing down. You're right. But at least he's got, you know, he's got a leg up on some other people coming out of college. So there you go. He's got something going for him. And yeah, because I mean, we used to have a grunter, I remember, in our room, it wasn't five, it was four guys. And, you know, like, you get some shit for it, but, like, I didn't, like, really care that much about it. Like, we made fun of the guy just because it was fun to make fun of him. But other than that, like, it didn't actually matter long term. So admitting that you're the guy getting spanked isn't that big of a deal. I'm just more worried about what she's going to ask you to do in the future if you continue with this relationship.
Yeah, what if she, like, embarrassingly pukes at a party in her 30s and she's like, go tell everyone you just puked outside and go
clean. Like, yeah, exactly.
Do it now.
Like at some
point. You know? I feel like my mind has changed a little bit on this. And I think Cerruti made the best point about like, dude, does it mean I have to take a bullet for everything forever? Like if we're actually going to have it. And granted, it's a college relationship. The chances of this carrying over into your real world life is probably pretty slim anyway. Although certain schools are different. Some schools, like people actually do meet their spouses there. Our school, we were told when we checked in, like the marriage rate out of Vermont was like the lowest of any national. It was unbelievable how low it was. It was pretty funny. And so as I've thought more about it, like if it happened in my house, it's not that big of a deal. Like we would have been, I mean, look, there's weirder stuff that happened where you'd be like, what happened? You'd be like, that's weird. And then it just, the next weird thing happens, it cancels out the previously weird thing. So It doesn't really matter. I think it's more about there's some root causes here of the relationship that are alarming. That's beyond just, hey, you have to admit that you got spanked. It's that there's this disconnect on like, hey, is it okay? Like, I don't want to deal with this. This is how I feel about it. Can we just let this thing go? No, I'm demanding that you admit that it's you for all these other reasons. Like this is really about an argument. It's not even about the spanking part of it. Cause honestly, the more I think about it, usually I'm pretty good at having like a sensibility of going back in time 20 plus years. The more I think about it, like if this, let's just say it happened to me, like I'd probably be like, all right, whatever. Yeah. Like whatever, dude. Like, you know, it's not that big of a deal. Maybe I wouldn't love it.
That it would suck for like a week and then like, yeah, I don't know, people get over it. Yeah. I don't know. Never.
Yeah. And honestly, like I said, if depending on what your friend group is like with us, that would have been Thursday. And then there'd be next Thursday. And no one would even care. And by the way, if the investment banking thing goes really well, you're going to be in your 30s paying for somebody to spank you. signing up for that lifestyle. So, you know, maybe she's doing you a favor. A lot of ways to look at that one.
I agree. Let me just say one thing. I think this is a good opportunity to test what happens if she doesn't get her way. That's what all I'm saying. All I'm saying is if you're thinking about going on to the next phase of your life, it's a good idea to just, the stakes are still relatively low. It's a good idea to just, what are you going to do if I don't? That's what, and you don't have to say it that way. Just see what happens if you're being, you know, yourself completely pleasant, perfectly pleasant, and just not doing this thing that she's commanding you to do. Just see what happens.
Yeah, there's no lose here because either, like some girls like guys that they can control, and I don't think you want to be that guy, so then you'd figure that out, or you're going to be like, hey, I'm not doing this, and she's going to be like kind of turned on by that, and it might actually help your relationship. So either way, I think you're all right.
Yeah, I have no idea how any of this is going to go.
I wonder if his friends follow up. I wonder like what her approval rating is amongst the people in the
low,
because I feel like it would be, yeah, I feel like it's not great.
Gotta be. There's no way it's high. There's no way. Bossing your buddy around, spanking him all the time.
Please follow up, dude.
I would love to know how anyone would describe this episode to somebody. Like, hey, what podcast is you? What are you into lately? Like, oh, this Russillo guy. Like, oh, yes, man, dude. It's okay. It wasn't great. Like, yeah, no. He had this episode the other day. He did the thing about like championship droughts, point guards, did his college football picks, and they spent 20 minutes talking about a college kid getting spanked by his girlfriend. I'm like, oh, well, hit that subscribe button. All right. Thanks to Kyle and Steve. Ringer Spotify, please subscribe. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you Monday.